Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that registrations will be opening very soon for my next 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools you need to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you're interested in finding out more, you can DM me the word ready, or alternatively, you can contact me through my website and we'll set up a time to connect. It's important I let you know that these groups run at limited numbers. Now, I do this intentionally so that it's an intimate space for you to do the deep inner work. But because of this, spots are limited and the April intake is already filling up. I can't wait to see you inside the container for a life-transforming experience. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today's guest is Lissy Turner. Now, you may know Lissy by her other name, Mel Bampton, from Triple J's Mel in the Morning. Lissy is an author, speaker, internationally certified therapist, the creator of the global phenomenon Like Aversion. She is also a mother, a grandmother, and the founder of The Prana Project. After many years of high-profile debauchery, Lissy made the decision to let go of the party lifestyle and has dedicated her life to becoming a support for compassionate living and better mental health. Today, as an internationally accredited senior yoga teacher and therapist, one of the few in the world that runs dedicated yoga therapy programs focused directly on the dissolution of unhelpful and harmful habits. I am so excited to dive into this conversation. So without any further delay, I'd love to welcome Lissy onto the show. Lissy, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you today?
I'm really good, Ash. Thank you so much for having me. I love a good natter.
Nice, isn't it? Nice little intro. Tell me, how has your Easter weekend been? You've been with your gorgeous family.
I have been. It's been really, really great. And I think it's always a good test, you know, as to how far you've progressed when you can spend entire weekends immersed with your family, because they're the ones that show you your true patterns, right? Where you're like, look at me, I'm doing so well in life. And then you can spend 24 hours with your family and you're like, oh, I've got some work to do. But, you know, this weekend was so beautiful. And I was like, I got to the end of this weekend. My oldest daughter and my grandchildren have just left. And I'm like, wow, that was so smooth. Like, good on us. Look at us, you know, progress.
That's amazing. It is a true test of spiritual fitness, isn't it? When you can be around your family for an extended period of time.
Absolutely. Like Pema Chodron tells this story about her teacher, Rinpoche, somebody, and he would have these students in that were, you know, deep into the practice of meditation and they were progressing towards enlightenment. And when the students would reach a certain level in their progression, this Rinpoche would say, okay, now it's time to go and spend some time with your family. And that, because that was the true litmus test of really, are you really there yet? And then he'd say, but just for 24 hours.
Absolutely right. It's funny. I was having a conversation with my dad the other day. He always says the other great place to test your spiritual fitness is in a group conscience at a 12-step meeting. It really can. You know, you've just got to deep breaths sometimes, but I always know if I'm running well, if I can get through one of those unscathed. Lissy, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. It is at the end of the Christmas break and you've made the time to join me and to join the audience and the listeners here today. And we have a wonderful conversation in store. I'm so, so excited. But before we dive into the depth of this interview today, I'd love to ask you some nice, simple questions to let our audience get to know you a bit better.
Great. So, just Missy, limber me up a little bit, yeah, Ash. I like it.
We're going to warm up.
And then you're going to blindside me with something. I'm ready. I'm ready.
I don't know if you could be blindsided, Lissy. I feel like you're an absolute pro at this, but look, I'll do my best. So let's kick it off with, where do you live? What does an average day look like? And what do you do for fun?
Oh my gosh, they seem like simple questions, but I'll get to the end of this and you'll be like, oh, I'm exhausted just hearing that. So where do I live? Simply, I'm in the Northern Rivers in New South Wales. And I say that more broadly because I actually live at the southern end of Bundjalung country, west of Lismore, and I also live just north of Byron Bay. So my husband and I are together, but we found ourselves in a co-parenting situation to just do what's best for one of our children post-flood here in Lismore. The kids had their schools there. They were destroyed. So we put one of our children back in a school where they were an hour away, and now we live between those two places. And the reason we do that is because the place west of Lismore is the headquarters to the Prana Project. That's our big regen property. So we've got regen animals here and there's things that need taken care of. So that's where I live. My average day, it really depends on what day of the week that you get me. So between running the Prana Project, between being a mother, I also decided to just do a little bit of an extra plot twist last year where I would take on a project management role for the local council. To help them just to continue to rebuild the city and help them with their arts and events programs, which is so out of left field. You know, anyone who knows me well is just sort of like giving me that sort of quizzical eyebrow when I tell them, oh yeah, I'm working for the local council currently. Again, you know, we're talking about those places where we get the opportunity to see how we've progressed, you know, and that's a really interesting situation for me, being in sort of a bureaucratic corporate setting, which challenges the anarchist in me again and again, who just likes to do things her way. So, but my mornings, but regardless of where I'm going and whether I'm running the business, whether I'm teaching yoga, whether I'm in my clinic, whether I'm at the council, I really try. The most important thing is in the mornings, my routines are the same, is that I get up in the morning and the first thing that I do is I go to the mat, I move my body, I consciously breathe, and I spend some time in meditation to make sure that I'm as ready as I possibly can be for whatever the day throws at me. So that's probably the most important part, is that no matter what the activities are of the day, there's this thread of, I love that term that you use, that spiritual fitness, that's going on from the start of the day, which begins with moving my body, goes deeper, and there's that thread of my spiritual practice being what is consistent for me each and every day.
Lissy, I'd love to know, talking about this time that you spend on the mat and connecting in with meditation in particular, does that look the same for you every single day, or does it shift and evolve based on what you have on that day? Because I personally am experiencing, I'm about 4 years into a consistent meditation practice, and I find that it can really ebb and flow based on what's going on in my life. And sometimes all I can manage is 3 to 5 minutes. And then I'll have other days where I'm ready to connect for a beautiful 20-minute silent meditation. What's your experience with that?
Well, it's a couple of things on that. So if there was a problem that was going on for me and it was a bit more consistent, like every day there's going to be things that we need to check in with. I need to arrive on the mat and I need to come from that place of, where am I? What am I bringing with me in this particular moment? Because every single moment is completely and utterly unique. So every day it's, where am I? So what's my starting point? And then, like you said, where am I going? What does my day have in store for me? So my practice has to be filtering out what debris can be, you know, dissolved or gotten rid of. So what am I coming with me in terms of, how's my mental space? How's my breath? What injuries or tweaks or sensations do I have in my body? Do I have sort of elevated, you know, that elevated energy that might be a bit more rajasic, like that drunken monkey energy? Am I a bit lethargic? All right, so this is my starting point. I've got to have that in mind, that I've got to reduce those things throughout the practice, and I'm moving towards what's coming next. So what does my day have in store? If, however, there was something that was an issue for me, like say I was nursing an injury, I've got a bit of a tweak in my low back right now, which I've really got to be aware of from surfing you know, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours a day for 3 weeks while I was just in Bali. And on the last week, I was like, oh, yeah, there's a thing there. So currently, because I have that, I'm nursing that. So that will affect the way that my practices are, even the way that I'm seated in meditation. And if it was something more serious, like I had an ongoing pathology I had to address, then my practice might actually be exactly the same in terms of these are the movements that I'm doing. This is the chant that I'm doing. This is the breath or the part of the breath that I'm focused on. And this might be the visualization that I'm focusing on my mind to bring me out of a particular problem. So it's really circumstantial to what's happening on that particular day.
I love that. It feels like it's very intuitively led. So it's like just about connecting in with your body and asking yourself, what do I need today? Rather than arriving on the mat with a specific set of tasks or practices that you need to tick off based on whatever you've planned that day. So I really like that. Thank you for sharing, Lissy.
My pleasure.
Now, you haven't always been this gorgeously enlightened yoga teacher and therapist, have you?
I just thought of my family's response, you know, having spent the weekend with them. If they heard you say that, they'd be like, who is this person you're talking about?
You've got a huge story and I really, really want to dive into that now. So, Lissy, let's start with your photo. I've asked you to bring in a photo from a time in your life where you are hiding behind a smile. So you were projecting one version of yourself to the outside world, but the reality was internally you were struggling. Lissy, I'd love for you to please describe for our listeners what this photo looks like. For those of you watching along, you'll see the photo appear now. But for those who are listening, could you describe what the photo looks like? And then for all of us, can you describe what was going on for you at that time in your life?
Okay, it's big. I'll start with just the visuals of this photo. And I just received this photo just a few months ago. And one of those amazing moments, you know, when a friend sends you a photo and you've never seen it before, you don't even remember there being photos taken at that time. And all of a sudden, this photo presents from such a significant moment in your life and you're instantly transported to that. So there's a couple of things about this photo. I'm sitting on a deck at a friend's place. Their house is, I can see in the background that their house is mid-renovations, which is interesting in itself because what that means then is my friend whose house I'm sitting at had just been diagnosed with cancer because it was as soon as they knocked the house down, then she was diagnosed. It was a really, really big thing. It was this incredible, oh my gosh, now you're out of your place and you've got all of this disruption and you've got this diagnosis now to deal with as well without having a solid, steady home. So the house is still being renoed, so it instantly takes me back to there. I'm sitting on the deck outside and drinking what I presume is a glass of water because in front of me on the floor is my tiny, tiny baby. So my tiny baby who only really looks about 2 months old, who has a really massive head actually. It's like, wow, he's got a big head, but he's also got, we were laughing about it yesterday because I was showing them and we were laughing because he's really, really intelligent, this boy. He's 18 now, so that's how long ago this photo is from. He's 18 now and he is our absolute brainiac and we're laughing about looking at this photo going, he's just a brain with feet. He's got massive head. Wow. Tiny baby feet. So he's laying on the floor in front of me and, you know, I'm a bigger size in this photo and it's that puffiness that if this is, in this case, it's postpartum, you know, I've got a tiny little baby here. So there's that. But I could look at a photo, say, from a year before that, before I was pregnant, and I'd probably see a similar puffiness, which is what confronts me when I often see older photos of me when I'm younger. But I somehow look almost older in some ways. And I'm not that I'm carrying a lot of weight, but I've got that puffiness of somebody who's drinking a lot, but you don't notice it at the time. And then you'll see photos down the track and looking back and you're quite shocking. So in this photo, I was relieved to see, oh, it's okay. I've got my baby on the floor. I'm postpartum here. So this is a photo, and the photo where it's situated is in Bondi. So I lived in Bondi for most of my time that I was at Triple J, which was absolutely amazing. I'd get up in the morning, I discovered surfing while I was there, which became and still is a very, very important part of my life and was an enormous part of my sobriety. It was, and this is a terrible thing to say as a mum because there was already a child and then children there, but it was actually surfing that was the first thing that really started to cut through the noise the night before, like when the drinks are flowing. This thought of, what if the swell's good tomorrow? Actually was the loudest thing to cut through for me. Obviously, you know, wanting to be not too hungover because I've got to look after the kids, but you get into such a rhythm of doing that. And I had been a mum since I was 21. So I was like, okay, my daughter can, you know, she can reach the cereal. There's milk there for her. So even if I'm really hungover, she can get her breakfast and we can have a slow morning. And so all those pieces of the puzzle had become routinely in place. But then the surfing started to cut through. So Bondi was a special place and it was a special time. But the pregnancy with my son, Tiger, and it's interesting that I use this photo too because through the pregnancies is when I wasn't drinking, but that in itself is, oh, I can do it for this baby, but I can't do it for me the rest of the time, nor you, my children, once you're out of my body, then I'm still going to drink and do those things. So at the beginning of this pregnancy, I didn't know I was pregnant and I was going on this amazing surf trip with Quiksilver. And I'd been in a surf competition, a charity surf competition, maybe 2 years before this photo was taken. And the head of my team was the head of Quiksilver at the time. And, you know, we had a great rapport that day and he said, you should come on this boat. And Quiksilver had this very famous boat called the Indies Trader. And it was a boat that was used to look for uncharted or unsurfed waves. So it was extremely exciting. And I, of course, you know, was absolutely thrilled to have that offer. So I surfed and surfed and surfed and surfed. I was a brand new surfer at that stage, brand new. So I spent the next sort of 2 years really getting ready to be able to go on this boat and surf well and have a good time. So that trip was about 10 months, 11 months before this photo was taken, probably 10 months. And I won't go into all the details unless you want details about them. You can, because it's a big story, but essentially I got deported from Los Angeles.
So, we need the details.
All right. So it's so stupid. I'm embarrassed about my, like just how stupid I was in my honesty. Like I wasn't embarrassed about anything else, but anyway, I'll tell you. So I'm flying to LA to then leave, do one night in LA because I had to do a stopover and then fly to Panama to meet the boat. So I was literally only going to be in Los Angeles for a few hours and then go straight to Panama to meet this boat. Like I said, been prepping for this for 2 years. So I get to, they give you the, you know, the green forms that you've got to fill out for immigration on the plane. And there's one question about, you know, have you ever been charged with drug use and or possession of drugs? And I was like, oh, I mean, I had when I was maybe 18, I got, you know, I had an ounce of weed and I had some seeds. And so I had been charged with possession of marijuana and possession of seeds. But because they were seeds, even though they were my ex-boyfriends from like 3 years ago and they were so like husky shells of themselves, they couldn't have grown anything, but because they were seeds, I got charged with intention to cultivate. So it was very, it was a long, it was 10 years previously, and I mean I might have even been 17, I can't remember if I was 18, 17 or 18, but I wasn't sure whether it was actually a conviction or what it was. So on the plane, there was another band there that I knew that I'd interviewed before on Triple J. And I was like, if anyone's going to know what I should tick in this box, because they just brought in the digital fingerprinting and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, oh, are we connected globally now? And that was the story, obviously, that immigration would have you believe. And so I wasn't sure whether I should lie or what I should do. So anyway, I went over and asked the manager of this band and I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, very seriously, we always tell our bands, it's absolutely essential, full disclosure. But normally we take care of this before we leave the country. And I was like, oh, shit, I do. So I'm just freaking out the whole time. I didn't sleep. I'm just, it's just on my mind. So I just didn't tick the box. I thought I'll just
just leave it. Maybe they won't notice.
Yeah, just like, so I get to the counter in immigration and I'm sort of trying to distract the immigration person, like, so how long have you been in this job? Yeah, look over there. You know, it's totally, it's ridiculous. Anyway, she just, of course, she just immediately goes, why haven't you ticked this box? And I'm like, well, was this circumstance? It was a long time ago, but I don't know. It was just a weed and I don't think it was a conviction. And she just ticks the box. She just ticks yes for me. And I'm like, okay. So then my friend who I was traveling with, she's already gone through. She goes, I'll wait for you at the other side. She's gone through and I get whisked off to the left. Anyway, I spent 24 hours in immigration detention in the airport and with no thought that I was going to be going home. It would just be a case that they were going to sort of push me through LA, get me out of the country and get to Panama. And then the worst case scenario was that I wouldn't be allowed to fly back in through Los Angeles. I'd have to change my flights home and I'd have to go back through South America, New Zealand, et cetera, to get home. So I'm like, okay, but it was pretty scary. You know, I think at that stage too, there was, I couldn't go, like I had to wee with an armed guard. Like it was so crazy, Ash. It was so, there was like four of us, all Australians who'd been pulled off that plane, all put in the same room. We're all just sitting on the floor in this space for this time and just, you know, having the weirdest experience. You know, Chappelle Corby's situation, I think, was still front and center of everybody's mind, even though that had been a few years before. Then the next minute, like after this immigration guy just telling me, you know, this is what's happening, we're not deporting you. And then I see all of my stuff on a trolley going in the opposite direction. And I was like, that's my surfboard. That's definitely my backpack. And then this immigration officer just said, yep, you are going home. I was like, excuse me? Like that is what? This is outrageous. I'm not even staying in LA. Like I've got a flight to Panama like now. And just put me on that plane instead of that plane and then I'm gone. Like there's not even, and he said something about, well, you know, you could be going to Panama to get opium. You could be doing anything. And I was like, this is so crazy. Then I got escorted onto the plane with two armed guards and had my passport removed. Your passport gets given to the pilot so you can't jump out midair or something. And the great thing was is that I got the whole row of seats to myself because no one's allowed to sit with you because you are a danger to yourself.
The silver lining.
The silver lining. So then I ended up getting sent back to Australia and I was so traumatized. I was so shocked. It was really, even though I'd been arrested before, I was in quite a bit of trouble when I was younger, but just, you know, really misdemeanor stuff. And the weed stuff was my biggest stuff. But it really shook me in terms of how helpless that we are, all of us really are, to the systems that are around us. And that's the first time I think my younger arrogance was really shaken. And so I went back home and Quicksilver were amazing. They were so shocked. They just couldn't believe what had happened. And so they asked me if I wanted to go back. Do you want to, the boat's traveling through the Panama Canal. Do you want to go back? And I was like, do I want to go back? And then I had to go, obviously I couldn't go through LA. So I had this crazy journey through New Zealand and then, you know, hopping through South America to meet the boat in Panama. And I decided that I would. It was just too much of a great opportunity. And then I got there, made it to the boat. I got sick a couple of days into the trip. I got quite sick. And there was a whole lot of stuff that went down on this boat. It was the craziest. It was the wildest trip. You know, that's a bigger story for another day, but it was like so outlawish. And anyway, I got sick. I was barely surfing. I was very nauseous. And then we had this circumstance where we got boarded by the Costa Rican Coast Guard and the boat was all sort of pulled apart and searched. And then I thought we were going to get locked up in a Costa Rican prison. And anyway, they let us off. But they kicked us. It turns out that our captain hadn't organized our visas for Costa Rica. So we were in Costa Rica illegally. And this was all supposed to be done at that end by the captain. And then we got moved on into Nicaragua. But then because We were coming into Nicaragua 2 days early than we were meant to be. We were boarded by the Nicaraguan military when we got there, and the boat was impounded in the Nicaraguan harbor. And that was the kind of end of the trip. But through all of this, I was very nauseous, which is bringing me all the way back around to why it's significant to this photo, is that through all of this, like I couldn't sleep. I was vomiting. I was having a terrible time, could barely surf. All this crazy stuff was happening. And then all of a sudden, amongst it all, I had this realization that my period was late. And I was like,
oh, wow.
Oh, no, hang on, wait a minute. And so my friend, my girlfriend and I, we found a pharmacy in Nicaragua, and I'm sign languaging like, baby, maybe I need a pregnancy test. And anyway, sure enough, I was pregnant with my now 18-year-old son, Tiger. And
wow.
I found out in Nicaragua.
So oh my goodness.
His pregnancy was actually so filled with so much stuff. And I remember another friend of mine who had cancer, she died through that pregnancy. And I didn't get to her in time back up to the hospital. I was working in Sydney for Triple J, and I didn't get back up to Brisbane in time. And so I organized to just see her body, see her one last time, say goodbye. And I must have been 5 or 6 months pregnant at the time. And so I did my goodbyes with her, and that was quite confronting. You know, it was 24 hours later, and just that coolness, you know, of that situation, of the body, of the room, of everything, and losing a friend. And then I just remember walking out with another friend of mine and just going, oh gosh, this poor baby, you know, this baby has already been, you know, I've had this crazy experience in Nicaragua. My husband at the time, the baby's father, had committed a crime that saw us essentially in court for the next 2 years. And now I was walking out of this morgue, and my friend said, you know, he's going to come out and he's just going to kick you in the shins. So I guess that's one of the reasons why that photo, when it was sent to me, was significant, was because it was really the beginning of life as it was breaking apart. Very dramatically breaking apart into all of these sort of different pieces. And that pregnancy had started with that Nicaraguan trip. And by the time, like on my due date, not the day that I went into labor, but on my due date, I was in court, you know, testifying, giving a witness statement for my then husband, who had, you know, committed this crime that turned out to be, you know, essentially the marriage fell apart because it was built on a whole lot of lies, and he'd attempted to commit an armed robbery that was totally blindsided me. I thought he was such a straighty 180. And so I was, by the time that my son was born, all of these parts of my life as it was with Triple J, in my marriage, having another baby, all those pieces started to kind of drift away from each other, and I had to make some pretty significant changes, which I did probably only, I think I wrote it out for another year or so. And then that's when I left Triple J. I left Sydney, I'd already left my husband by that stage once the truth had all come out. And it was me and my two kids starting another life, which led to a really, really beautiful life. But again, I look at that photo and I see, you know, how happy, you know, I'm so happy to have that baby boy, my beautiful baby boy, to have a son. I had my eldest, is my daughter, and so to have a son as well. And I was just so happy in that space. My beautiful friends whose house that was, and so took care of me and my children and nurtured us through that time, having this incredible job still on the radio and of being at the prime of that part of my career on Triple J, and then having all of this crazy stuff happening underneath with my then husband, my marriage, the chaos of my drinking, my drug taking, which wasn't, of course, happening just at that specific moment because I had a baby and I was breastfeeding, but it was going to pour back into the space with great vigor again once my son was old enough, once I wasn't breastfeeding, because I was in the absolute sort of catastrophe of a life falling apart.
My goodness, Lissy, that is just a huge story. And I'm waiting for either the Netflix series or the movie because it has to be made. That is just 100% a given. Before we get to this catalyst for change, I would love to know, was this colourful life of yours up until that point, do you think it was your destiny? Do you think that you were born with this rebellious streak, this desire to want to colour outside the lines, or was that something that was modelled to you as a child? Where do you think it all came from?
That's such a great question. I seeing how I piece, I guess, the two parts of myself together, which is that young version of ourselves, you know, that has all of the innocence of a child, and then the life, the world pours into that space, and then that leads us on a whole other direction. But I remember being, and my mum always tells me that as a child, I was such a quiet little dreamer, you know, and I remember just the magical world of childhood. And I also remember the grief of it fading, very, very distinct grief as it was fading during adolescence. You know, I've told this story a little bit over the last few years. It's come up in different ways of just, you know, I lived in suburban, the western suburbs of Brisbane, and this very suburban place, which is so built up now around Redbank Plains, Kimmira, Forest Lake. I mean, it's so crazy how built up it is now. But back then it was predominantly bushland or farming land. So there was the very beginnings of suburbia starting, and but still a lot of space around these little clusters of suburbia. So it felt spacious. The quarter acre block, the standard back then suburban quarter acre block, to me as a little child was an entire universe. And every time my parents built a new garden, that's where I would then spend my time. Like I could lose myself in a tiny garden with my pet rocks, and I could be there all day. And I skated from a very young age. I was always just skating around and around the house. And I remember just often on the weekends, putting the garden hose out in a circle in the middle of the, you know, front lawn, and that would be my island. And I'd pack a little bag and I'd have snacks and water, and I would live on this island, this tropical island, all day, and there'd be sea all around me. And I would just remember that being so incredibly real. And so I think there was something that it was definitely not, there was no rebellion in any of that when I was a kid. I was so, like, I think, you know, I probably did give my parents a little bit of cheekiness, but that was more about me wanting to keep playing, keep doing my thing. So I just enjoyed all of those bits. But then when the pressures, I think, started to really come into play around the expectations of how other people think that you should live your life, and they started to kind of all of a sudden press up against me, and then the rhetoric about me was that I was rebellious, or because I didn't, like, I think the dreamer was very much sort of leading the way, and this is how I was going to live a life. I wanted to do these things. I wanted to paint. I wanted to, you know, I the whole idea of just grinding into a job for the rest of my life until I died, just even as a kid, I was like, awful. My parents were stressed. They worked all the time. I'm like, no, this is not the way. And so in just innocently thinking that you're going to carve a different path, sometimes if that doesn't meet with the expectations or the conditionings of others, of course, they then push up against you. You should be doing this. You should wear this. You can't go out of the house looking like that. You know, I probably went through my goth phase and my this phase and that phase, and listening to, you know, Iced Tea and all of this. And I always loved old school hip hop and lots of swear words. And my dad was an atheist and my mum was a born-again Christian, and so there's all of this conflict all the time about different things, and there's me in the center of that, just wanting to do things differently, and that was butting up against the structures and the systems around me. And so I think that that label of being rebellious or an anarchist was more pushed on me. Like I did not, that's not, that was never my intention. It's just, I just sort of saw what was happening around me and thinking, that's rubbish. I'm not doing that. I'm not going to be stressed. I'm not going to be this. And again, my kids will laugh because life has a way of really building up stresses on you, even when you try otherwise. So I think that I really, through my teenage years, dug into that. I'm going to do things differently. And as soon as somebody says to me, oh, that's not how things are done, or you can't do that, or like when I had my daughter at 21 and you know, it was a tough ride for her because I was so wild by then. But she did, you know, she saved me, she reined me in. But that wasn't easy for a small child with a mother who drank a lot, who was working in the music industry, who was taking lots of recreational drugs. And even though I tried to keep those things separate, of course, I was always going to be subpar in that situation. There were always people at her house. There was always people, you know, coming over to hang out or staying over who were on tour or whatever. There was a lot of that saturation of that lifestyle in her life. So I think that when I was a single mom with her for those first 5 years of her life, there was a big part of me because I would hear those things. Like I remember being at radio school, studying radio, and the teacher pulling me aside at one point and saying, you know, you won't be able to do this as a single mom. And that was like a red flag to me of motivation. And like, that's not, I suppose it was this thing, and maybe it was arrogance, just going, if I want to widen the parameters for other people. So even if they don't want to walk where I've walked, they don't feel that they're confined to this very narrow path that we're so often told that we need to walk, that I could be an example of, you know, to another, not in lots of my other behaviors, but in some of my behaviors, where someone could go, but, you know, Mel Bampton did it. She had a baby and she got a job in radio and went on to do things and with a baby. And it's funny because now full circle, I spend as much time with my children as I possibly can, and the careers are very much secondary to that. So I was definitely the essence of me wove all the way through, but I think being rebellious was that kind of focused intention to be rebellious didn't develop until I could see how confined everything was.
And when did you know that you wanted to move into radio? So you mentioned that you went to school to study. How was that path forged for you?
I was living in far north Queensland at the time. That's where my eldest daughter was born. I was in quite a bit of trouble, as I mentioned before, with the police when I was living in Brisbane and when I was younger. Then I moved to Western Australia and I actually worked at the casino there as a croupier there at the casino for a couple of years. Bought my first house when I was 18, maybe 19. And then we're back when you could do those things, unlike now. And then I came back to Brisbane for a moment, got in trouble again with the law as soon as I was back. And a heap of us did. So we decided that we'd head up to Far North Queensland, thinking that that would be a really good place to stay out of trouble. And for those people back then, that was probably, that must have been sort of mid-90s. Heroin was just a huge part of the drug scene. You know, everything has these different arcs and waves and it comes to drug use and the cultures that come with them. And I just hated that scene. For me as a busy person who just wanted to do things, I was like, I could not think of anything worse than just laying around all day and like sleeping and vomiting. I was like, this is ridiculous. But it was everywhere, all around me. So when we were getting into a bit of trouble in Brisbane, a couple of that crew and myself, those who were using heroin, they were like, let's go to Far North Queensland because we'll escape the heroin scene up there, which was the opposite. You know, got all the way up there and it's beautiful, but the heroin scene up there was rife and in a very closed, much smaller space. So the impact of that was very, very great. But what that crew, whether they were using drugs or not using drugs, it was sort of the central element of creativity, particularly musically in Far North Queensland, in Cairns. And I was surrounded by musicians, singers and players, and I can't do either. I mean, I'm not a terrible singer, but I think with some time I could potentially be brave enough to sing something on stage, but not enough to feel confident to be engaged with this musical surrounds. So radio offered me a way to be involved in this music scene without being a musical person, without being a player. So I got involved with the local community radio and I just loved it. I just loved then being able to at least engage with music in this way because I loved music. I just wasn't a musician. And that enabled me a place within that scene. It's funny, it probably boils down to, you know, that sense of belonging, which is so much of how we get involved with drinking too much and taking too many drugs in the first place. But this was a really positive version of that. So I got involved with community radio up there in Far North Queensland. And then when I came back down to Brisbane, I knew I wanted to pursue that more with more focus, not just community radio. So then I went and studied at the radio school, where my teacher told me that it wouldn't be possible because I was a single mother. And so I got my first job in radio down in New South Wales in near Jindabyne, and then got my job at Triple J, which was absolutely amazing. Amazing.
Oh my goodness. And especially back then when radio was just radio, well, they were stars, people that were on the radio, like that's who you listened to. It was the same few stations that you'd tune into. It was a different world back then. And I just imagine, like, how did your young mind comprehend the fame and everything that came along with that at the time?
Oh, I don't think I really had a perception of that until I left. And it was because I suppose I was so young when I went into it, and I had been so, so lucky, and I'm so grateful that it's not an easy thing to necessarily get into in terms of getting a great paid job. But I was so lucky. Like when I finished my course, I wanted to pursue Triple J as my avenue, because I was pretty wild. You know, I was pretty out there. Triple Z in Brisbane was my radio station. I was pretty punk still by then. I skated everywhere. I was drinking a lot, taking heaps of drugs, doing all the things that everyone was doing. No heroin though. All the other stations were so boring. Like, I loved radio, but funnily enough, I actually did. One of my first radio jobs that I got was at a classic hits station. And I think I was the youngest there by about 20 years as a broadcaster. And I faced lots of piercings in my face. I don't know. I mean, that kudos to that station manager at the time for just going, we need some young blood here. We need a woman with tattoos and facial piercings in this completely out of place setting. But that was really, that was great. That gave me a sort of great leg up. And then in that time, I went over and had a chat with the amazing Costa Zulio, who worked at Triple J then. And Triple J was looking at expanding back out into the more regional cities rather than just being Sydney centric. And so that was beautiful timing for me. Costa Zulio is an amazing man. And he was like, I've got someone who I want to put on. And they needed someone else in the Brisbane office, or they wanted somebody, and that was me. So that just had timing on my side. And then in terms of, yeah, I think because I'd been saturated in it for the next sort of, well, really since then in some way or another, I mean, I'm very, very grateful for the profile and what it allows me still and what it did allow me then. But it wasn't really until I left Triple J where I was like, oh, okay. When you don't have that, there are some things that are harder. You know, there was things like I'd taken advantage of how I could go to everything, whatever was going on, and I'd never paid for a single thing, and I didn't even have to ask. My name was always on the door for everything. But it was actually really great that some of that was being reined in, because it meant that I wasn't as easily out as often as I had been, and I needed to be there for my daughter. So, but the funny thing is, and you'd probably relate to this, is I had this national voice back then when you're younger, when you really shouldn't have it. Like when you're like, oh my God, did I say that out loud? I did. Oh no. And I just sometimes just think it would be so much better if, you know, we were in our 40s before we got a national profile.
Yeah, and because you can't take it back, right?
But I sometimes think, because there's so many cases that come, you know, you hear about lots of legal matters that come up that are historical, and there might be 20 years down the track, and then these people who are not that person anymore paying the price for something that was done by somebody that, yes, was them, but is not them. Like, we change, we grow, and that doesn't mean that we there still shouldn't be consequences for things. But oh, that cringiness of when we're younger and the things that we say and the things that we do. But that's okay, because we are also young and we're finding our way. And then when we go into our 30s and 40s and probably 50s and 60s, we more refine, you know, who we want to be, not just who we were as a consequence of the circumstances around us.
so true. It's almost like this beautiful, like we're there all along when it's this process of just allowing the expectations and the judgments and whatever else to fall away, and like the core of you is revealed with age. It's like that's why I'm starting to understand now so many wonderful people that have told me, you know, it just keeps getting better. Like I'm really starting to step into that now, and it's wonderful.
How beautiful that you've had people around you to tell you that too, because sometimes it could be annoying, right? But it's also when you get there to that age that they might have been saying, like maybe that they were at when they were saying it to you, and you get there, then you remember, then that bit of wisdom is really meaningful in that moment. And no doubt you've gotten to some of those places and gone, ah, right, now I get it. And then because somebody said it to you back then, you can lean into it more deeply. Well, what is it? What is it that's better about this? And then you can give it names and you can identify it and be in the deeper appreciation of that because somebody took the time to say, it's okay, it's just going to get better.
Having that moment just to pause and reflect and actually pay attention as well to appreciate the moments rather than just kind of continuing to move through life and not actually stop to, you know, smell the roses, as they say. Lissy, I have one more question, and then I really want to move into the wonderful being that you are today and the incredible work that you do. But I have to ask, like a version, you have created something that has stood the test of time. Can you share with us, what does that feel like? You know, when Australia Day rolls around and you see people getting together, like it has brought people together for so many years now. Like how does that feel for you?
Yeah, it's a bit disassociative, to be honest. It's kind of weird. Yeah, last year they did the Leica Version Hottest 100 for the first time. That was a momentous event, and it felt really momentous for the station as well, because the Hottest 100 has been what it was for, you know, since its inception. But to do the Hottest 100 with a theme was really significant. And so, and it was also coming up for 20 years of Leica Version as well. So there was a lot of radio interviews last year that I did around Leica Version, and that actually felt almost very therapeutic, because it's been such an interesting journey for me my whole time at Triple J. Now I get the chance to really enjoy it. And funnily enough, I've just started back with Double J last week, just filling in for the beautiful Kaz Tran on Classic Albums. And I'd continue on ABC work and different work throughout, but coming back to Double J and being ready and wanting that for the first time in a long time has been significant. But the thing with Leica Version is that, you know, obviously it's gotten so huge, so absolutely enormous, millions and millions and millions of downloads. But because my relationship with my time at Triple J in relation to my journey with my daughter was very fraught afterwards, because when I left, she must have been 10 or 11, and my husband at the time, as I'd mentioned, had just attempted to commit that armed robbery. We were in the middle of this whole sort of sentencing process that went on for years, and just untangling the depth of the lies that had existed in that relationship and around that crime. And it was a real tangled mess. And then that took me away from my daughter as well, quite significantly. You know, it robbed my daughter. It was the end of her childhood, and it robbed me of our time together. It robbed me of the first year of my baby's life from that photo, because we were deep in this court case for somebody who was actually, you know, lying about why this had happened. And so I gave over time in the wrong places, and I'd also given time over to the wrong places in relation to my job and to drinking and to drug taking and then the hangovers and all of those things. And that time at Triple J, because there was so much time out, it was also when all those other events I've just mentioned happened. Then in terms of the next couple of years, it got worse before it got better. I was working remotely for the ABC and these different things. But then when as my daughter started to have a few things happening for her, really significant things in her teenage years, I was dissecting my whole parenting life, you know, with a microscope, and just feeling so much guilt, so much shame for every drink, for every night out, for getting into a relationship with this person that stole so much from myself and my children. And I found it very difficult for a long time to reflect positively about my time at Triple J, because every time I'd think about, like, people would say, you know, I went on so many tours, and then I continued to do so in the music industry, working for various festivals. I'd met every amazing human for a decade who was doing incredible things, and it was sort of that pinnacle from that perspective. But then the question that always followed for me was, where was my daughter? And she was, of course, would have been always cared for, and she would have been with a friend or with a family member. Or, but immediately in the memory was, where was my daughter? And then that realization that once she started to get into trouble and have some really hideous things happen to her as a young woman out there in the world, and it was tearing me apart, I couldn't reflect on that life with any positivity. And then at the same time, like aversion is just arcing up into this huge thing that exists out there in the world that I had created. And so I'm trying to kind of hide from all of that. And there's this thing that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And every couple of years, you know, journalists would ring me because it's had a new milestone or whatever. And I'm in this like, no, I'm just a yoga teacher. I'm just Lizzie Turner doing my things, and I'm just doing my practice over here, and I'm sober. And I'm like, I was just trying to put my head down to get to be better, to do better, to feel better. And it's really just been in the last probably 2 years, and certainly last year, like I said, when it had its hottest, very first like aversion, hottest 100, when it's coming up for that 20-year anniversary, and there were so many conversations around it, when my daughter is in such an incredible place, and I've got my two beautiful granddaughters, and all of those things are healed. I mean, there's wounds that aren't healed, and they may never be healed in this lifetime for my daughter, for me as a mother. But I could finally celebrate again, and being able to wrap my arms around like aversion last year when all of those interviews were happening, and go, yes, like aversion is awesome, and I absolutely love it, and I am really proud of it, and I'm proud of the journey that it's on. But I think as well in the significance of the things in my own life that are really important, it's not the most important thing, but I'm so happy that it brings so much joy. And the other thing, just lastly on that, I had probably just been kind of writing it off a little bit. I was like, it's a pretty simple idea, you know, but for me, it was always about the stories behind those songs for the bands. Like, as an interviewer, I've always just wanted to be, who are you underneath this song? Who are you underneath this album? Who are you underneath this look? Or who are you in there? Like, what's your tenderness? What's your wounds? What's your joys? I love that stuff. That kind of is like the great equalizer of us all. Who are you underneath all of that, regardless of profile or anything else? And like aversion was really a way, another way, is a tool to kind of, when you've got seasoned artists in front of you, they're so used to just putting that mask on. But like aversion created a way to get in another way behind the music that they loved and chose to play, was another way to find out more about those people and those artists. So last year was an incredible celebration, and people emailing me to say, you know, these songs, some of these songs that I got introduced to through like aversion, they actually changed my life in this way, because this really hard time was happening for me. And then this song came out by this band and I never heard the original, and then I blah, blah, blah. So all of a sudden, this thing that I was probably writing off in my biggest story is a bit frivolous, I was like, oh, actually, don't do that. Don't do that. It was one really, I should be proud of it, and I am. I'm really proud of it, and it means a lot to a lot of people.
That's so beautiful. Yeah. I'd love to know, when you made the decision to get sober, because you were just describing then this real battle of wanting to have a sense of pride for your past, but then also there was this guilt around what it took from you at that time. Was there any fear around losing your identity when you got sober, Lissy, or was there almost like a yearning to create something new to be able to free yourself from the guilt of that time in your life where maybe you weren't showing up the way you wanted to?
I think because I'd already had a loss of identity situation when I wasn't Mel in the Morning anymore, or I wasn't at Triple J, all of a sudden I realized, oh, I actually have to have a decent personality. I realized I'd gotten quite lazy, you know, like I knew inevitably where every conversation would go every time I met somebody, or I laughed at the pub and they'd recognize my laugh, or I knew the conversation would just go there and then I could just talk about the job. And I was like, I was lazy in my personality. I was lazy in the richness that, you know, there was a much deeper versions of me, but I had just gotten so lazy and probably a little bit blasé about making connections with people. So when I left, when I decided to leave Triple J, well, when I had to move away. I was leaving my partner. I couldn't afford to be in Sydney with the circumstances that were going on and a very expensive legal case. And so I had to leave, and I was still doing things for the ABC, but it was when I left and then moved, I had a place up the coast where I'd go to surf, and I took the children up there and we lived there for a couple of years to kind of regroup. And then I was like, oh, because I'd been this for a long time, and I had not, you know, things you don't realize their impact until they're absent. And only when they're absent then from your life, like drinking, do you really get the full scope of how you were, how it was impacting you, how much time it was taking up, how often you were thinking about it. You don't really see a thing until it's gone, and then you really see it. And so that full identity thing happened, I guess, at that time when I left Triple J, and I was like, oh, right, okay, like who am I now without that? And then when I moved from there, and I moved up to Byron, and I was just about focusing on me and the kids. Just don't meet anybody. Just don't. Just be you and the kids. Just heal. Write your book. I had a book deal then with HarperCollins. Just do your thing. Put your head down. And I was there for a month. And then I was at a friend's dinner, and someone who I'd met 10 years before, she'd invited over. I think she very much knew that there would be a great connection with us. And anyway, then I met my next husband, who I'm still married to today, and we have a, you know, a big life together. So in terms of the sobriety and the self-identity piece, which is, as you would know, in all the work that you do, it's so huge to reassure people that it's okay, you're going to be okay. This is just such a, even though it feels so big because so many aspects of your life seem tied into this one thing, it's just a little, just a kind of little dirty speck in who you are. Like it doesn't feel like that right now, but it is that. And so I don't remember really going through that too much with drinking. I do remember there being those shifts in people inviting me to things. That definitely happened. And I know that's a very common story. It's all of a sudden this, you know, one particular group that I don't think I got invited to anything ever again after that. But that was okay, because I was so putting my head down into how are we going to shift our lives? How are we going to heal? Underneath all of that was my daughter was in a really terrible domestic violence situation. That was what was going on for her. She was very young, 14, had been drawn into this situation with a much older man, and it was very, very dangerous. And so we were living in this space for maybe 8 or 9 years, trying to extract her from there. And it was unbelievable to discover how difficult that was. We couldn't get any police assistance. We could not get her out. So my life was so focused on how do I save my child? How do I keep my child alive? You know, waiting every day for that phone call that she would be murdered. And it was just so saturated our lives. So that had just sort of begun. Her wild journey had just started when I went sober. And I think because such a big part of my decision to go be sober was the realization that where my daughter was potentially going to walk, where this path was going to go, and where she was at, starting her own, using and experimenting with substances, I was not and could not be enough. I could not be what she needed me to be if I wasn't at my full capacity. And I could never be that if I was drinking. So that had to go. And I had to do everything that I could to make myself big enough to deal with the enormity of the situation that lay ahead. So the sobriety was just kind of one thing that was like, that's got to go. But also, I have to say, that my body also, I got to a point where I couldn't actually drink. I had a really easy out after 20 something years of drinking. My last big bender, I had a 2-week hangover and I could not keep another drink down again.
Wow, there you go.
I know. So I feel like a cheat, actually.
Not at all.
Like I tried to give up a few times before that and I had for maybe a month or 2 months or whatever, short periods of time. And obviously I hadn't been able to. And then after this one last big tequila night, being so sick for 2 weeks, so in the like all the stuff that goes on mentally. And then when I still tried, after 2 weeks, I gave it another nudge. And I, as soon as I, that whatever it was hit my tongue, I was vomiting. And that was that. So cheater.
Well, like it says, when the body says no, like it's just, nope, we're done here. You know?
Yeah, but look at Ozzy Osbourne though. Like he's still going. The body, where's his body saying no? I'm sure it is, but he still keeps going. It's crazy.
Insane, isn't it? That level of tolerance. My goodness. Lissy, let's talk about the yoga then. At what point did this come into your life and how has this influenced your transformation or maybe perhaps evolution is a better word?
The yoga framework is my absolute everything. Obviously, my kids are my motivator. They're my number one motivator and wanting to feel great in my own body. But that piece that I was just talking about with my daughter, needing to make myself as big as I possibly can, so as large as her circumstance got, I would be larger, so I could keep going. So the yoga was an enormous part of that. Then how it acts as a consistent thread. I mean, you would know, right? Like it offers you something in every single circumstance. There's never a circumstance when you're deeply immersed in the framework of yoga where there isn't an answer there for you. That limiting of that confusion that causes so much suffering when we're just walking around bumping into things going, I don't know what to do. I don't know what decision to make. This person's doing this or I feel like that or blah, blah, blah. When like the yoga framework for me has offered me everything in every circumstance. It's like, okay, if I'm, my body feels like this, then do this. I feel my nervous system elevating like this, then do this, use this tool. What do these guidelines of how to be in relationship with myself, others and the world tell me? If my mind's careening down this path of whatever, negativity or sufferance or whatever, it's like, hang on a minute, just put the brakes on. How can I filter this back through this particular framework or this particular text or your understanding of this? And, oh, right, okay, there we go. And I think when you've been through really big things and you've had it as your underlying foundation, you really just are so blessed with such a seeing and a knowing of how it can get you through. Because if you can keep your nervous system steady and if you can keep your mind clear and you can keep your body in as ready a shape as you can, then you can deal with whatever presents, even when it's the most enormous thing that you could ever, ever have imagined in your worst nightmares. And that's what yoga has been for me. So, you know, how it came about, I mean, I'd been practicing yoga for a long time, all the way through my crazy, I started when I was 20 practicing yoga and on and off very sporadically as you do. It's just like, and you could probably relate to this, like you get smashed, yeah. Right? And then on Tuesday, you're like, I'm going to yoga. It's all good.
Yeah.
Fine. I've got my yoga class.
Yep.
It's so true. Oh, look at me. I'm having a salad. I'm fine. All right. And then now I've got that in the bank. Now I can also go and get shit-faced again. So you're always kind of leveraging, right, off those things. And so my yoga practice for a time was like, it was a bit like that. But I'm sure it was doing deeper things. And what it was doing, I suppose, was forming a relationship for me with these tools. And back then it was very much just a physical practice of yoga. And that's a fine doorway. That's such a small part of it, as you know, but that's the doorway for so many great. Whatever your doorway is, fantastic. And then, yes, when I went sober, yoga absolutely poured into that enormous space. Because it's not just the space when you're drinking, is it? It's the space of when you're hungover. It's the space of which bottle are we going to? Oh, we've got to swing by there. Or we've got to, you know, do we have money in the account for this? And, you know, it's all of these different bits and pieces. And then, of course, it's all the bigger feelings like, oh, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I said that. I'm so embarrassed. It's so saturating. So when you go sober, it's such a big space left behind. But yoga is the infinite project and it's so big. And I think that's why it's so effective for so many people who are looking at sobriety, because it can just pour into that entire space. And there's never a moment where there's not something that you could be doing in your daily life that's not yoga. So no matter where the mind goes, no matter how the body's feeling, no matter what the circumstance it's presenting, you can be in yoga. You can grab a tool to help you in that situation. And so it was very much a direct equation between sobriety or letting go of booze and the yoga just filling that space.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I often talk about it like that God-shaped hole in the soul. And when we remove the alcohol, which is what we were using to fill that hole, we need to find other things to fill it. Otherwise, you're walking around with this gaping hole and you feel, eh. So the practice of yoga, I love what you said then. It's infinite and it is greater than the hole will ever be. And you can continue pouring into it in many different ways. And while we don't have time to dive into the details of the framework today, I love what you said about the physical practice, the asana, being just the footing in the door to what is this beautiful, expansive way of life. So for anyone that's listening and that sort of piques your interest, I'd really encourage you to do some more research into what yoga actually is all about, because it's actually that moving the physical body is a very small part, as you said, Lissy. Yes, absolutely. Lissy, can you tell me, and if this is too personal, then we don't need to go there, but I'd really love to know, I can see from the way you talk about your children today that you have done some serious work to heal those relationships. How have you gone about doing that?
I think the connections have always been there. Like with my eldest daughter, that was the big struggle and the big learning. I was a kid having a kid, you know, I was a single 21-year-old having a baby. And there's lots of very mature 21-year-olds out there. There's probably 16-year-olds out there having babies who are way more mature in some ways than I was. Like I was out in the world living like I was an adult, but I was wildly out of control. But I loved her so deeply. Like I remember when she was born, I was not angry, that's too strong, but I was so confronted by this love that blew me apart and I was not prepared for it. And I could not believe that nobody, of all the unwarranted, unasked for advice that you get when you're pregnant, nobody said, your heart is going to explode when this baby is born. Nobody warned me. And I was so ill prepared for that kind of love. And I just did not know what to do with it. And I think actually not knowing how to wield that level of love was the foundation for a lot of how I was parenting, which in that I was parenting out of fear. I parented a lot out of fear. Plus, I had a wild, amazing, beautiful daughter who wanted to devour the whole world like her mother. But she had such an incredible heart. But I was like, this love for her is so great. I don't know what to do with it. And I was so, it came with it, this fear of what if something happens to her? Well, I'll die. I can't handle this grief. I couldn't handle it. That was always a bit of a seed in the back of my mind. And I think that as much as the booze probably impacted the way that I made some poor decisions with my parenting and just wanting to keep her so close, so tight, which was bizarre considering how often I was out there in the world doing things and was away from her. And then the rest of the time was fear. So there was these sort of extreme things going on. And then, like I said, she was 9 when my ex-husband committed that offense. And so that was 2 years where that really important time in her life where she needed me. And I was so just trying to hold us all together as a family by focusing on this thing, just get through this and protect her. Don't let her really know what's going on until we absolutely have to. But children can feel that stuff. They know something's going on. And so I kind of lost her in that little window from it being her and I and being so tight to just losing her in that little window and then spending the next however many years trying to get her back, and which I did. And there was this crossroad moment, which I think is significant to your question, where, I mean, she was a nightmare. Like, not just the stuff, it wasn't just a nightmare, the stuff that we were, like, she went to the underworld, and as her mum I had to go to, you know, you don't have any choice in that. I had to go to all the places that she went. And, but she herself was so challenging. She had such a big personality. She always wanted to go beyond whatever the boundaries that I thought were safe or whatever. And there was no getting, like, I must have tried everything in the, you know, parenting, child managing handbook that was ever tried in the history of the world. But when she wanted something, that was sort of it. So there was this crossroad moment where I can't even tell you what she called me. She would be so horrified too if I said it out loud. But she called me a particular phrase, two-worded phrase, which you could never say on the radio. And she only referred to me as that for about 2 years. And she was about 14, 15. And even when she was happy, she'd just be like, hey, yeah. I'd be like, oh, my gosh. That was just one thread amongst many of these really intensive behaviors. And then she was using, and she'd gotten into methamphetamines. And it was so difficult to watch. And there was this crossroad where I thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. I need her away from me. I can't handle it. I can't handle the things that she says. I'm actually a bit scared of her and who she's becoming, and I can't do it. And I don't know whether I should have her around the other kids, because my husband also brought 3 children into our relationship as well. So there was, at that stage, there was 4 kids younger than her, and we had a baby that made it 5. So there was 5 younger kids. I don't know whether I can have her around the kids. I don't know what to do. I can't do it. I can't do it. And I sat with that for maybe a couple of weeks, this feeling, I can't do this anymore. And then what came to me in just continuing to just practice, do my meditation, just let it come through, was that, well, I can't not do it. Can't not do it. What am I going to do? Like, just cut her off and then she dies. And then what? Have you got your way? Have you got your solution? Of course not. So I had that incredibly strong realization, I can't not do it. So what does that mean? And this all happened around that same time as the yoga pouring in, the sobriety. You need to make your love so big, so big, because it's all there, but it's condensed down into this tight ball of fear. So rather than it be this expansive love of care, the fear is making it so tight and bound within you. It's all love, but it's so bound. So you need to figure that out. So I need to just go, like, how do I make it enormous? The love, love, love her. I did things like I changed all of my passwords to I love Jazzy. Jazzy is so beautiful. Jazzy is so clever. So all of this stuff. So every day, in all of these other ways, rather than just not just in my mantras, in my yoga practice, I had mantras everywhere in my daily life. That would be all the beautiful things, because for years it'd be like, oh my God, she's doing this, or she's like that, or her behavior's like this. Always saying all these negative things that weren't untrue, but they were just focused on that. So that was all part of this healing process with her. How can I make my love big, 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 big? And but it's really, again, that age-old story, since she's had children as well. And I'm so enamored with my grandchildren. I can't even breathe when I look at them. They're so cute. Oh my gosh. And we're so close. And that in itself as well has been that next layer of healing. And she's in such an amazing space. She's such an incredible woman above and beyond. She will be one of those people like you who has gone through these experiences and then out the other side, they're fully coming into themselves. And I just looked at her this morning, and she's so healthy and she's so strong, and she eats like this and she moves her body like this. And I'm just like, wow, that's the richness of her soil now to help so many people. And she's currently studying to become a drug and alcohol counselor, funnily enough.
Wow. Oh, Lissy, my heart is beaming. Thank you so much for sharing that story.
There's no short stories, is there, Ash? Bloody hell.
I could just listen to you forever, honestly, when you said like about the idea of making your love bigger than anything else could possibly be. It's so true. When we are led from fear, everything's in a small ball, everything's confined, we're holding on to life tightly. But the opposite of fear is faith. And when we can open up and have faith and open our hearts, then anything is possible. And the fact that she's, you know, at the point she is now, like clearly at work, you know, that's just, oh, so beautiful. Thank you for sharing.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's lovely to talk about those things and just see that all the bits and pieces that we go through and that the people around you go through. I mean, it's all just being human, right? It's just so much of it's just trying to figure out this crazy, wild human existence that is fundamentally human.
Exactly right. Well, that's a perfect segue into the final question that I have for you today, Lissy. And it's all about how you stay human. My question is, I ask all of my guests to share this. What are your three non-negotiables that allow you to live your life today happy, joyous, and free?
Oh my gosh, I've really contemplated this quite a lot in knowing that it's your common question. And I'm hoping that you can relate to what I'm going to say as an answer, because I think having non-negotiables is not something that I really actually do have. One, as a yoga person, because I have to learn to be able to negotiate on everything. Being a mother, I have learned to have no non-negotiables, because if I do, then something will push up against those and cause conflict. And there's a beautiful expression from one of my teachers, and it has really been at the center of so much of my learning, which is, there is nothing absolute and everything is relevant. But that said, what I do need, the things that I do know that I need, is that I need my good health, whatever that looks like. That doesn't mean I don't have days of poor health, but that navigation, what do I need to do to come back to what is my fullest health in this moment? So that's my food, what we grow, you know, how we interact, what I take in on social media, what music I listen to, what movies we watch. It's everything. It's all encompassing health. I need to be outside. Like I would say, if I had one non-negotiable for right now, but of course, if I was confined, then I would have to negotiate on that non-negotiable. Being outside is so incredibly important to me, whether that's just walking outside to sit on the front deck for a moment and just look at the trees, whether that's being in the ocean, my great, great love, and surfing or swimming or just being in the river or whatever it might be. My health, my outdoors, and I think the other sort of negotiable, non-negotiable is how I can best be with the people that I love in a way that meets the standard that I want to be moving about the world with. So I'm not going to bed at night and going, oh, really? I shouldn't have said that. Or, and I mean, I am saying that often because, of course, I'm fucking it up like we all do.
We're human. Yeah.
That humanness. But I'd say they're my things that are most important to me.
Love that. And it's so, so true what you said. It's so counterintuitive in a way to have non-negotiables if you're living with this idea of non-attachment, but then to almost have them as just these guiding signposts. This is when I'm living my best, these are the way I show up for myself. Can be a nice way to look at it as well. Thank you so much for sharing, Lissy, and thank you for your time and your beautiful stories here today. If people want to find out more about all of the amazing things that you do, where can they find you?
Probably the best place is just on the Prana Project website or the Prana Project Instagram or on my Instagram. I'm pretty readily available on those things, even though I try to keep them under control, as I'm sure we all do. But those places, particularly the Prana Project, will have all of the things that we've got coming up. And I've got two dissolving patterns programs coming up soon. And so they're my big things. But have a little squiz around there. And even if it just inspires you to get outside and plant a tree today. Then have a little
squeeze. Oh, I love that. I'll make sure I pop all of that information in the episode show notes. Lissy, we say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time here today.
Ash, thank you so much. Now, the one thing I want to say is we need to have our conversation in reverse soon, where I'm asking the questions and I get to just hear more and more of your incredibly perfectly crafted phrases that you use. And as a wordsmith, I love it. I love the way that you craft a phrase. So thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Such a pleasure, Lissy. Take care. I'll speak to you soon.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.